Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how bad carbohydrates, that's the majority of what we consume in our country, increase risk of cancer by up to 88%. And then remedies to soothe poison ivy rashes. If you should be one of the people who should be unfortunate to get poison ivy, poison sumac, poison oak, I've got some good solutions for you. And lime juice could save hundreds of thousands of lives each year. How so? I'll explain. And grapes protect against ultraviolet radiation. Then we're going to look at some environmental issues, including why are the fish suddenly dying by the hundreds of millions? Yeah, the media has not covered it, but over the past several months, there has been an alarming number of dead fish and other sea creatures washing up all over the planet. In fact, in some places, more than 30 tons of fish have washed up dead all at once. Remember I mentioned yesterday that a horse can sense an earthquake before anyone else, as can birds, and they get out of harm's way or try. Could all these dead fish be telling us something about the Pacific Rim and what's happening there? But most of my program today will be devoted to trying to address some issues that have not, in my opinion, been addressed fairly and with any depth. And that is, people are lining up to either vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. They're looking at Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, progressive, Bernie Sanders. What if I told you none of the above is true? And to understand this, I'm going to use some things that were stated last night by Bill O'Reilly when he was discussing Obama, this progressive liberal. Obama has nothing in common with either being liberal or progressive. The trouble is everyone makes statements and no one follows up with the details and the scholarship to show. So today, I'm going to explain what is a conservative, what are their principles, what is a progressive, and then I'm going to go back to Ronald Reagan and show you how each president since then either embraced and expanded upon those ideologies or did not, and why we need a completely different type of candidate offering for the first time, actually the first time, actual progressive ideals. Now, I'm going to expand also on a concept, and I wrote about this late last night because I began to see something that it just clicked. It was right in front of me, and now I see it. We keep talking about the 1%, and I keep saying that's wrong. There is no 1%. It doesn't exist. You have 1/10 of 1% that control as much wealth as 50% of the entire world's population. They matter. They're the policymakers. Everyone else simply hides under their wings. Then why have we seen no major social change at all in our society? Now, unless I miss something, we didn't protest in any measurable amount the invasion of Libya or our involvement in Syria, regime change in the Ukraine or in Honduras. We have not stopped home foreclosures. We have not given forgiveness to student debt. We are still engaged in private prisons and getting back to jailing the poor. Poverty prisons are back and filled with hundreds of thousands of people. Asset forfeitures by police just stopping you and stealing your money or your car. It's into the billions of dollars a year and increasing. Where's the protest on any of this? Drone strikes. Where's the protest? Extrajudicial killings. Where's the protest that we have troops, ground troops and mercenary troops in 167 countries in the world? Those are sovereign nations. What do we do to get in there? Why are we there? Where are the protests? So I'm going to share my insights of what I think is the most clever move imaginable, where there will be no protest at all. there will be collapse within certain segments of our society, and that's because of what we're not looking at. Today, I'm going to be sharing with you my own commentary, blended with William L. Robinson of Truthouts, Six Urgent Matters for Humanity in Global Crisis, what he calls sadistic capitalism. So that's a packed program. Let's begin. First up, we know, this audience at least knows, the difference between a good carbohydrate and a bad. A good carbohydrate would be lentils, pulses, all of your split peas and beans. Those are terrific. All of your nuts, walnuts, almonds, pistachios, root vegetables, rutabaga, parsnips, and beets, whole grains like brown rice. These are good carbs. The bad carbs are the muffins and the sandwiches and the toast and the buns, hot dog buns and hamburger buns, potato chips and french fries, things that are browned. Here's the latest on this. Quote, evidence of how harmful certain carbohydrates, the bad carbs, can be to our health keeps mounting, and a recent study adds even more motivation to cut out those sugars that trigger the growth of cancer cells. The study has shown that consuming foods dense with unhealthy carbohydrates can significantly increase the risk of prostate cancer. Now, this audience knows that prostate cancer is the second leading cause of death in men from cancer-related illnesses. And the bad carbs refer to any processed foods and sugary beverages known for their sugar and processed grain content, like your sugar-coated cereals. These foods have now been found to be markedly increasing cancer risk. Conversely, healthy carbs, like the ones I mentioned a minute ago, the whole grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes, are preventing cancer. And the new study shows that those who drink sugary beverages, such as sodas and sweetened juices, are 300% more likely to get prostate cancer. And a higher intake of processed foods like pizza, as well as packaged burgers and meat sandwiches, was found to double the risk of prostate cancer. In contrast, eating healthy carbohydrates, like your legumes, and actually prevented breast cancer by 67%. So that's good to know, because then whatever you choose is up to you, but at least you'll know you have some healthy options, or you have sick options. Summertime. You know, people get out, going in the woods. Do you know what poison ivy looks like? Poison oak, poison sumac. You should familiarize yourself, because let's say that you're walking and you might be walking through it, but you don't really notice because you got hiking boots on. And well, now it's the oil is on the boot or on your sock. And when you go touching that boot or sock, you're going to have it on your hands. That's why when hiking, always wear your socks on the outside of your pants. Always wear white socks. And that way, if you should get a tick or anything else, you'll be able more likely to see it. Then when you get home, just simply take the sock off from the inside. Pull it down, put it in the wash, put some bleach in it. That disinfects it. Then put it through a normal wash cycle. Take some bleach and alcohol, wipe down the outside of the boot, that disinfects, it helps. But what if you got it on your skin? All right, and you're going to have a bad reaction. What can you do? Well, there's certainly some things that can ease up the problem. Tea tree oil. Now, this is an essential oil. It's great all around, natural skin remedy. And once the rash has stopped oozing, tree oil can be applied in diluted quantities, generally 20 to 1, to the skin every 2 hours to stop the itching and dry the blisters and rash. You don't want to put it directly on because it's too hot for the skin. Probably one of the best is aloe vera, the whole leaf aloe. Just get a whole leaf aloe and open it up and take that warm, that cool gel and massage it into the skin. That can help reduce the inflammation, the swelling, the itching of the skin. And it's a great natural remedy for soothing poison ivy or poison oak rashes. It reduces itching, pain, and irritation. Also, you can drink aloe vera which helps from the inside out. You can use it both topically and outside. Also, what is called Jewel, J-E-W-E-L, weed, Jewel weed. And it counteracts a lot of the efforts of poison ivy. It's what is known as a succulent. It's a member of the impatin family. You crush it and apply it to the rash. This alone is by far the best help of any of these treatments, Jewel weed. Then witch hazel, made from the bark of the witch hazel tree. It's an astringent. It's soothing and relieves the itch of poison ivy. And also oatmeal bath. Now, this is something that I saw when I was growing up that was used. They add a cup of oatmeal to a tepid bath, and room temperature preferable. And it's a wonderful way to relieve irritated skin. Make sure the water is not hot, because hot water can cause blisters of the rash to burst and spread the infection. So that's one other thing. And then internally, not externally, internally, take 1 teaspoon every 4 hours of black cumin seed oil. We know about lemons. We know a lot about lemons, and they're good. What do we know about limes? Well, the lime is best known for its role in key lime pies, or if you're a drinker, margaritas, or vodka. But in this case, there's a lot of research going on about the lime and what it can do to help interfere with diseases. And the latest is that it can help with sickle cell anemia, and that affects an awful lot of Americans. About 95,000 are diagnosed every year. And malaria. Malaria, of course, is a mosquito-borne parasitic disease, and it caused about 219 million cases of illness, with about 660,000 deaths each year. And they try all kinds of toxic drugs, but lime juice had the strongest anti-malarial activity, and it clears it from the parasite from the system better than the other things. And then it's a good bacterial agent in food. A recent study found that the popular food contains natural agents which can detoxify some foods. And it was good against some salmonella, which is a common food poisoning. Of course, you don't want to be eating anything that's been out in the sun, because it could be contaminated, or something that's been thawed and frozen again. And you can always tell if something is thawed in the freezer and then frozen again, because it doesn't freeze evenly after that. It'll be, if it's fruit, it'll be like there's a large chunk of ice in there. Well, that's your fruit that was thawed and refrozen. And you don't want that if it's been thawed and refrozen. But also lime juice in water can help disinfect water. In fact, it killed the norovirus as well as the E. coli. It's been found to kill the cholera pathogen, which is believed to affect about 5 million people, cause over 100,000 deaths a year. So if you're traveling somewhere and you're not sure about the water you're drinking, squeeze the juice of 2 limes into the water, stir it around, then drink it down. It can kill some pancreatic cells, which are notoriously difficult to treat, and it can also help people who want to stop smoking. They gave a nicotine gum or lime juice and found the lime juice was used as effectively as smoking cessation. And also, grapes protect against ultraviolet radiation. Now, I'm a big fan of grapes. I think they're one of nature's most perfect foods, the grape skin and seed in particular. Well, the Spanish Foundation for Science and Technology did a study published in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. And what they found was that there's some compounds in grapes that protect your skin cells from the sun's ultraviolet radiation. And that was also done at the University of Barcelona. And the study supports use of grapes or grape derivatives in sun protection. And so if you go out in the sun, take some vitamin C and quercetin, but also take some resveratrol or grape drink the grape juice, grape concentrate, grape powders. They're all good for you because it can help protect your skin from skin cancer, sunburn, the solar arrhythmia, as well as premature aging of the dermis and the epidermis. So all good, and that's just the latest on health and nutrition. Now, I want to shift gears here for a moment because there's a lot happening with the fish. Now, this happened a couple years ago, but then it's happening right now again. And according to Nation of Change, Ruth Milka, just over the last 2 months, there has been an enormous quantity. We're talking about hundreds of millions of fish and sea mammals dying and just being washed up on the beach. In fact, Chile, I don't know if you've ever been to Chile, but they have one of the most massive coastlines of any country in the world, some of the most beautiful beaches in the world. Right now, it's not so good. It's just loaded with dead animals. This is from the Smithsonian Magazine. Quote, as Giovanna reports for the agency Press of France, the South American country's beaches are covered with piles of dead sea creatures, and scientists are trying to figure out why. Tales of dead animals washing up on shore are relatively common. After all, the ocean has a weird way of disposing its dead on shore. But Chile's problem is getting slightly out of hand. Recent months have not been kind to the Chilean coast, which has played host to washed-up carcasses, over 300 whales, 8,000 tons of sardines, and nearly 12% of the country's annual salmon catch, all dead. And that's only in the last 2 months. So, in fact, the fish are piling up so fast on the beaches in Chile that they can't clean it up. They got bulldozers and they got dump trucks. Can't keep ahead of it. Now, in Vietnam, there's also incidents of dead fish. They've had so many dead fish that they've had to deploy their armed forces to bury them. Quote, millions of fish have washed up dead along 125-kilometer stretch of Vietnamese coast in one of the communist country's worst environmental disasters. And soldiers have been deployed to bury tons of fish, clams, and occasional whale that began dying in early April along the north-central coast. And in southern China, 35 tons of dead fish appeared in a lake, one small lake in the Henan province. In Bolivia, thousands of dead fish washed up on the shores of Lake Alalay. And in Brazil, more than 200 tons of dead fish were removed from the Furnas lakes. And several more examples include in India, Cambodia, Colombia, and Indonesia. In most of these cases, the causes are unknown. So here's the question. Could it be climate change? Could it be something happening at the bottom of the oceans in these areas where you have pre-volcanic activity releasing sulfur, which changes the pH and changes the water, making it highly acidic, which will kill a lot of different... We don't know yet. I'm merely saying that something is causing this. No one knows what it is. We're going to take a brief break. Then I'm going to come back, and I'm going to go into some things I think are very important about our understanding where we're going as a society. And if you don't want to get caught up into the crisis, we've got to pay attention. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall in New York, or being in New York shortly. I'm going to tie three things in that are all interrelated, and you'll see how they're interrelated in a moment. But I have to pull back for a moment and ask myself, when I hear Rush Limbaugh, and I try not to hear Rush Limbaugh, but I like to see how's he handling issues, and Mark Levin, who's probably the funniest guy on radio, and also Michael Savage, Laura Ingraham, certainly the strongest voices out there would be Bill O'Reilly, and though he calls himself an independent, and Sean Hannity. Now, they all consider themselves classic Reagan conservatives. On the other side, Hillary Clinton's trying to position herself as being the new Democratic Party. But then Bernie Sanders saying, no, I'm the new Democratic Party, and the young people are believing in me. And Barack Obama says, but I'm the ultimate liberal progressive Democrat. And people are confused. Let me explain why they're confused. First, let's just take the basics, something that everybody agrees with. And everybody who's out there looking at what is being said, you would have to ask, what does it mean to be any of these things? So I want to start by going through the basics here. First and foremost, what does it mean to be a Reagan conservative? The principles of Reagan conservatism. This is their Bible, so it's important we all know this. First, when it comes to freedom, Ronald Reagan believed freedom was a universal principle, but this extended into economics and private interests to exert its freedom of conducting business and generating wealth. For conservatives, individual freedom equals private interest freedom. Then faith. Conservatives equate freedom with faith, and this takes on the religious connotations common to Republicans. Without religious faith, freedom leads to anarchy. And the conservatives are afraid of anarchy. They believe in the individual, the Ayn Rand concept. Republicans give importance to individuals, hence individual entrepreneurship and deregulations to advance individuality. Democrats focus upon the collective, that a nation is only as strong as its weakest citizens, and government has a responsibility to care for its poorest citizens. The family. Conservatives emphasize traditional Christian moral values. They believe that these values sustained in a family will keep society stable. Reagan was a staunch believer in family values. The sanctity of human life. Conservatives base this on religious texts, and what it fuels is anti-abortion. American exceptionalism. Find this throughout Republicans and conservatives. U.S. Manifest Destiny is extended to apply throughout the world. Reagan was a staunch supporter of conservative views of nationalism and patriotism. Lower taxes. A commandment of conservative Republicans. Small government. Another commandment. You were not to ever challenge that. And then, in fact, they were fanatically anti-socialist and fanatically anti-communist. Ronald Reagan embodied these. Capitalism is viewed religiously to further conservative interpretations of freedom and faith. Socialism, large government, social welfare, regulation on private interests are all antithetical to Republican conservative free market capitalism. And finally, peace through strength. Another Republican commandment, the belief that constantly increasing military strength and weapons and more advanced super bombs will stabilize the world and keep it at peace. Okay, at least we know what they believe or what they're supposed to believe in. Now here's the question. Do they manifest this? Let's start with Ronald Reagan. These are all facts. Perhaps one of the more anemic modern presidents when it comes to a mix of liberal and conservative principles and policies. Reagan proclaimed early that the U.S. entered the age of the entrepreneur, so we saw this with the rise in junk bonds and mergers and equity partnerships. Now, why is that important? Because until mid-1970, 74, 75, you had every reason to believe that if you went to work for a place and you were going to work there the rest of your life, at least if you came from the South where I did, you would have maybe one or two jobs your whole life, then there would be a living wage, you would have savings, you'd be part of a community, your community would have been there forever, your in-laws, family, and friends would be there forever, you'd have safe houses, good schools, there'd be no truancy, no acting out, there was no bullying, bullies were dealt with quickly, and there was a sense that the police were there to serve as much as to protect. That is what that meant. All right? Now, in comes the junk bonds of the Reagan administration and the mergers. And then you have Michael Milken, T. Boone Pickens, Carl Icahn. Those three are all alive. Saul Steinberger, who's dead, and Ivan Bosky, who's passed. They started to do both green mailing, junk bonds, very high yield interest, 10, 12, 14% you get in return, but it was high risks. But also, they began to take over companies that had been there forever, that had little or no debt, and were the anchors of a whole economic base of a community, and they would buy into the company. If it was a private company, they'd pay off the owners enough to have them say, okay, here's my company. We've been here for 100 years. Take it. Or they would buy into a public offered company till they had control of the board, and then they would get it privatized. They would load it with debt, strip off its assets, and that's when the jobs started to be decimated. But at that time, there were still more need for jobs than there were people losing jobs. So people would go out of one industry and find a job somewhere else. That lasted for about the next 15 to 20 years, and we lost about somewhere around 15 million jobs, but they were absorbed into the workplace elsewhere. But then companies started to fold completely. Too many companies, thousands and thousands of companies and factories had been purchased, were loaded with debt, and now they had no choice. If they wanted to keep competitive, they had to outsource those to cheap employment countries like China. So as our economy went down as far as manufacturing, and service jobs went on the increase, service jobs paid very little, manufacturing and union jobs paid a living wage, you started to see the decimation of whole communities, where we began to close iron companies and steel companies, and you ended up with rust belts. Then Ronald Reagan attempted to privatize Social Security in 1983, but he failed. However, he did raid the Social Security Trust Fund, replacing it with IOUs. How much is the Social Security Fund today owed? Over $2.2 trillion. They used that money. If they were so good and they believed that you don't want to exploit big government, well, then why didn't you rely upon the private sector to fund these? You didn't. You took from the taxpayer, one of the contradictions. Then his anti-regulation position ended by staffing the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Interior with anti-conservation and anti-environmentalist people. These were policy wonks. These were technocrats. These were the best and brightest out of Harvard, Yale, and these other schools that came in looking to be a part of the party and just be a smart, good, obedient calculator. But what happened to all those good Ralph Nader regulations that were put in place? Scrap them. So who pays? We pay. He was a serial tax raiser. To the contrary, the myth about Ronald Reagan was that he reduced taxes. That's a lie. He raised taxes 11 times during his 8 years in office. But his big business stance and his experiment in supply-side economics meant cutting taxes for rich and raising for middle class. Supply-side economics turned into a religion for the GOP. But it never worked. It only worked for those who got the tax breaks. Well, how smart are you if you open up a corporation or business and the only way you can survive is by getting breaks from the government? I thought you were supposed to be anti-socialism, and yet the biggest users of socialism in American history are the supply-side free market globalists. The Ronald Reagan, the godfather, broke that door down, and then we, the people that they disdain, have been paying for their subsidies ever since. They also broke the unions. They sided with Wall Street's CEO salaries doubled during his term and rose another 150% under Bush Sr. However, actually, Reagan was much less a hawk than Clinton and Obama. And this, I think, is a puzzle to the true conservative. Although he increased defense and launched new weapons programs, which were redundant and worthless, including his Star Wars program, which was just asinine by any measure, but it helped the contractors. He willingly negotiated with Gorbachev frequently and admired him as a reformer. That was good. And although polls after the collapse of the Berlin Wall credited Gorbachev by 43%, and Reagan by 14%, it wouldn't have come down without Gorbachev. But Reagan was a part of that, and that was a positive thing. As governor, he liberalized California abortion laws. As presidential candidate, he advocated for a constitutional amendment to ban all abortions. But as president, he did more than any other president to prevent Roe v. Wade from being overturned by appointing Sandra O'Connor to the Supreme Court. They don't give him credit for that. Again, this is the contradictions within the conservative movement. He established the precedent in 1981 of the libertarians and the Tea Party right-wing agenda, meaning no government is too small. Government is the problem, and so therefore reduce size of government. But everything that he and every president has done since then is to increase the size of government. If you really feel that the government is too large, then why don't you reduce the military-industrial complex? You could take $1 trillion a year out of their budget, and it would not undermine our defense at all. How about the pharmaceutical industrial complex? You could give single-payer coverage, and if you wanted something else, you could have private payer for those that wanted their own insurance and own medical treatment. Fine, let them have it, but for everyone else, it's single-payer. That would save all the administration, which is about 33% of $3.5 trillion a year. You're talking over $1.25 trillion a year saved. Also, you get rid of defensive medicine. That saves you another $200 billion. You will get rid of a lot of the medical errors that occur. That's over $200 billion. You will get rid of all the high-priced drugs that are out there. That's over $200 billion. So you're looking at nearly $2 trillion a year saved if you really cared about small government, because it's government that finances that through Medicare and Medicaid and through the fact that the government pays for most of the research that's done. Then we turn over the, after we pay them to do the research, we turn over the patent rights to them. So then why don't you do it right? Honor your word. But they won't. Now, aside from the 1986 bombing of Libya, Reagan didn't place troops on the ground for regime change anywhere. In fact, Reagan was a big disappointment for the Pentagon hawks at the time. Almost tripled the federal budget deficit. He increased it to $3 trillion by the end of his term. That's Ronald Reagan. He increased the size of government immensely. We had soaring unemployment during the first years in office, rose to 10.8%. By the way, it was 7% when he came into office. And he gave amnesty to 3 million undocumented migrants and removed sanctions that stopped employers from hiring undocumented workers. Thus, 3 million people and millions more of family members got residency. And so why doesn't Bill O'Reilly talk about that? He didn't care about AIDS research or AIDS treatment, and until he was embarrassed to do something about it. And he signed the U.S. Convention Against Torture. Now, this is something for Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, and Richard Pearl, all the other neoconservatives, and the people in the Justice Department and National Security Agency. Your hero, Ronald Reagan, signed the UN Convention Against Torture. It specifically banned torture under any circumstance whatsoever. So you're engaging in heresy. Then you're not a true conservative if you say you're basing your conservative ideals. Now, he had scandals, Iran-Contra, selling arms to Iran secretly while there was an arms embargo, and these sales went to fund Nicaraguan rebels, which Congress had prohibited under the Boland Amendment. He vetoed the Anti-Apartheid Act, which would have placed sanctions against South Africa. That is rampant racism. And his role in creating the Taliban and bin Laden, funneling billions to Afghani Mujahideen in the U.S. proxy war with the Soviet Union. That just gives you an idea of the complexities of what we're dealing with. But then we have Bill Clinton. Now remember, when you're electing Hillary Clinton, you're electing Bill Clinton, because this is a ruthless tag team. One does not function without the other. And she's taken pride in bragging about how she was in on every important decision, every single conference. She was there. She was probably the most proactive, get into the mix, wife of a president in American history, possible exception of Mary Lincoln, but set that aside for a moment. Clinton and Gore ran as a team promoting, what did they talk about? New Democrats. Aren't we hearing that again now? Yes, we are. What did that mean? It meant that they were going to align themselves financially with big business rather than the public to promote neoliberal free trade capitalism. Even the conservative right-wing think tank, the Cato Institute, named Clinton as the second most conservative president of the post-World War II after Reagan. Mitt Romney used Clinton in his ads positively to attack Obama in 2012. And Paul Ryan praised Clinton for bringing us a conservative Republican welfare reform. So for all the people who were considered welfare queens, there were a couple, but millions were not. They suffered because Clinton did what no Republican would dare do, but he got away with it. And Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, believed in the principle of small government. Under Clinton, annual welfare spending was 0.1, deficit spending was 0.1% of the GDP, gross domestic product. Under Obama, in his first term, it was 8.4%. Even Bush expanded the government during his first year far more than Clinton did in 8 years. Expansion of federal funding in education, boosting farm spending to record highs, and protectionism on steel and lumber imports. With Clinton, his conservative Republican policies and bills that move policy in a free market-oriented direction included, for example, NAFTA. And Clinton loved prisons. There's no president in American history that would rather throw your worthless ass in jail than Bill and Hillary Clinton. And if you're black, man, do they love to put your ass in jail. But the blacks won't accept this. Too bad, because the progressive blacks do. Cornel West understands this, and they understand that there has been no human being in the American history who's done more against and more to support the incarceration of blacks than the Clintons. And how many people are in prison today? 2.4 million people and 160,000 serving life sentences. It was Bill and Hillary Clinton's 1994 federal crime bill, an infamous three strikes law, all of which were written by a lobbyist for the prison system, that put people in prison and didn't educate them and didn't retrain them for jobs. It was a deliberate choice to punish without education. Now, a few weeks ago, I think it was 2 weeks ago on 60 Minutes, or 3 weeks ago, they showed you a Norwegian prison. And here's a man who's on death row, but he's out at a seaside resort having lunch with his family. And the 60 Minute producer saying, how in the world are you here having lunch at a seaside resort? He's, well, at nighttime, I go back. You know, I come out in the daytime, and then he showed all the things, how he'd be reinformed. Yes, he committed a crime, and yes, no one denies the seriousness of the crime. But in Norway, their idea is, let's reform these people. So all these prisoners have their own little legislative body. They decide upon the projects. You get to learn in whatever areas you want to get education. You want to learn crafts, skills, psychological counseling. You get it all, because the purpose there is, you have a key to your cell, not the guards. You're not locked in by the guards. You lock yourself in. You unlock the door, you come out. You go to school. You go to gym. You watch theater. Whatever you want to do, you're there to rehabilitate. Now, they have a very low recidivism rate. In the United States, very high, because we don't educate, we punish. And you can thank Bill and Hillary Clinton for making sure that any effort to actually rehabilitate people and retrain them was squashed. And then you have the infamous, punitive, welfare reform bill. In 1996, Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, taken directly from Newt Gingrich's contract with America, played into white fears of black crime and poverty. In 1996, 68 of 100 families with children in poverty received cash aid, and by 2010, it was 27. That you can thank to the Clintons and their Wall Street and private corporation backers. Oh, and Bill Clinton was the Wall Street deregulator-in-chief. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were responsible for more damaging financial deregulation than any other president in history. He signed more financial deregulation bills than any other president in history, including Reagan. He scrapped the Glass-Steagall deregulated risk derivative market with Commodity Future Modernization Act. He gutted state regulation on banks with the Regal-Neal bill, leading to bank mergers, reappointed Alan Greenspan to the Fed. He destroyed manufacturing with free trade agreements in 1993, NAFTA, which opposed labor unions and liberal Democrats. Reagan proposed free trade pacts between U.S., Canada, and Mexico in 1979. Well, NAFTA, through Bill Clinton, killed 700,000 manufacturing jobs, permitted corporations to cut their wages and benefits, contributed to illegal farm workers by selling farm products to Mexico. Clinton essentially brought socialism to the corporation of the 1%. It was he who did this. Then you had the Defense of Marriage Act, right out of the conservative playbook that defined a spouse as heterosexual and deprived same-sex couples of benefits, Social Security benefits, hospital visitation rights. And fortunately, it was found unconstitutional in 2013, but not because of Clinton. He expanded the war on drugs. Now, mind you, it was Richard Nixon's war on drugs that got all this going. But it was Clinton who campaigned that when he was running for office, he said, let's help the prisoner. But the moment he got in office, he did 180 degrees, and he continued the ban on federally funded needle exchange programs. He banned food stamps for anyone convicted of drug offense, including marijuana. He prohibited drug felons from living in public housing. And as a result, federal prison spending rose 171%. And guess who's one of the biggest funders, the Clintons, Bill and Hillary? The prison corporations. And also, public housing under Clinton declined 61%, but the prison population doubled during his term. He has done more to harm the black and Latino community than any person in the last 100 years. And yet, the irony of it is, they will vote for him in a heartbeat. Why? He is not your friend. Both of them have been your enemy. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton escalated foreign drug wars, Plan Colombia, the multi-billion dollar effort to reduce cocaine production, which he could give a lecture on, and with his brother and his friend Dan Lassiter, and 80% of it went to the military that was aligned with radical right-wing paramilitary groups, death squads. So under Clinton, a lot of people, innocent civilians, were killed. And then he led this to hundreds of thousands of becoming either killed or refugees within their country because of narco-terrorism. He expanded the death penalty. Traditionally, it was a conservative position. His 1994 crime bill increased death penalty to 60 additional crimes, including espionage, treason, drug trafficking. You could be put to death under his for trafficking in drugs, selling drugs. And throughout his presidency, he ignored efforts to put a stop on federal executions. He signed the Effective Death Penalty Act to speed up sentencing and executions. The Clintons wanted you dead sooner. How about that? Well, you will see the New York Times and all of its reporters reporting that. Not a chance in hell that the New York Times will ever say anything negative about the Clintons. And he gave rebirth to the Cold War mentality. He went against all agreements George Bush had made with Russia's Gorbachev in ordering the Eastern Europe NATO orbit. And that's where we are today, that Hillary Clinton wants to expand. He became master of shock doctrine by intervening in Balkans, Poland, Czech Republic, with corporate buyouts of those nations' industries under neoliberal International Monetary Fund loans. The Ukraine and Russian conflict under Obama is a direct result of Clinton's policies. And he bombed the Sudanese pharmaceutical plant in 1998. The plant provided Sudan with 50% of its medicines and was the primary source of the nation's anti-malarial drugs. Did they care? No. Did they go in to clean up the mess and try to rebuild it? No. Did they think about all the people who were sick and needed the medicines who would die? No. And then you have the sanctions against Iraq. It decimated the Iraq economy and civil infrastructure. They intentionally, which is a war crime, they intentionally targeted electric grids and water purification plants. Now, that, just so you understand, that is a crime against humanity. That is not forgivable. There's no statute of limitations on that. And they could, because the documents actually were retrieved under Freedom of Information, the Defense Department showed that this was an intentional effort by the Secretary of Defense to knock these out. That in turn led to 500,000 children dying, according to UNICEF, because of sanctions that they couldn't have clean water drink. Now, Saddam Hussein's 80,000 National Guard, you know, his Republican Guard, they had water. They had filtration systems in the palaces, good food, medicine. But to the people of Iraq, they did not. And to this Shia, he was Sunni, they did not. So 500,000 children died. And on 60 Minutes, in an interview with Leslie Stahl, Madeleine Albright, who had served both as Secretary of State and UN Ambassador, said that it was worth it. And when I heard that interview, I thought, how is it possible to say it's worth killing 500,000 children? But that's how the Clintons operate. By the way, evidence now shows that the Clintons knew Rwanda genocide was coming and did absolutely nothing about it. They interceded. So understand, when you're getting the new Democrat in Hillary, that's what you're getting. And who's giving her the most money? Wall Street. So what's the likelihood of real reform? Non-existent. Just more the same. Who's most likely to take us to war in an international theater, such as allowing the Likud party under Netanyahu to destroy Iran? It wouldn't destroy Iran. It would hurt it. But Iran's a big country, and they've been waiting for this attack. So just imagine the world economy when Iran is attacked, and it looks like they've been hit with a lethal blow, but then you have 1 million armed soldiers coming at you who are trained in urban guerrilla warfare. They're going to take out the Saudi, Kuwaiti, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, oil fields. They're going to sabotage those. They're going to sabotage the Straits of Hormuz, where all the tanker ships have to go through. Oil is going to go to $200 a barrel at that point because of scarcity. So imagine what it's going to cost for a gallon of gasoline. You could be looking at $10 a gallon. How's it going to impact flights and driving and commercial costs? Because whatever is going to be increasing costs, they're going to pass it on to the consumer. No one thinks of the consequences of all this. She's so ready to start another war. She is the most warm-minded politician I have ever heard of, outside of Winston Churchill. And I'm going to deal on a special commentary for those who are rather illiterate about this great man. He was right up there with one of the greatest genocidalists in history. I'll prove it in an upcoming program on the truth about the stupidity of colonialism and imperialism through the English history, including through his time. So that brings us to Barack Obama. Now, what really got me to do this today on this section is because last night Bill O'Reilly is telling Charles Krauthammer how President Obama is this progressive. I have yet to see a single thing that Barack Obama has done this progressive. He's not only not progressive, he's not liberal. He is Democrat in name only. He is a radical conservative in everything he does. And the magic of this man is he's able to do it and get away with it without critical thinking. Where are the critical thinkers? Well, Chris Hedges is one, but he's not in the mix. The critical thinkers are excluded from the discussion. In fact, Obama is conservatism in the classic sense, but he takes it one step further that no other president has done. He takes it towards complete totalitarianism. In fact, you could say that Barack Obama is the president as dictator-in-chief. Why? It has nothing to do with personalities. It has to do with record. Let's look at the facts only. Just historical, accurate, documented scholarship. Nothing more. He increased warrantless surveillance and spying on citizens. All citizens, no exceptions. He increased collaboration between private industries and the CIA, Homeland Security, and the Pentagon, whereby corporations are now an arm of the U.S. intelligence agencies. He militarized all law enforcement. He privatized the federal programs, but still operating as an extension of the government. Hence, private prison systems, if they lock you up, and they have an incentive to lock you up, because the state is now guaranteeing that they'll have so many beds in these private prisons filled, and they're making money off each person. And it's not about rehabbing them, it's about warehousing them because they're profits from warehousing. Give them cheap food, give them minimal medical assistance, give them no training, nothing at all. Not like more enlightened countries. But then if it doesn't work, the government steps in and subsidizes it. That's that private partnership, private-public partnership. He renewed the Patriot Act and opposed reforms submitted to protect civil liberties. He has prosecuted more whistleblowers under draconian laws than all of the presidents combined. He created the right of the president to order assassinations, including drone strikes, without any legal process whatsoever, and kill anyone, anywhere, at any time in the world with no repercussions. He appealed Middle East prisoners' habeas corpus rights to challenge legality of detention. The National Defense Authorization Act that grants the government the right to basically arrest anyone at any time for any reason, without any due process, without knowing who's arresting you, why you're being arrested, and to keep you detained or to kill you in detention, disappear you, he created. He granted immunity to anyone who authorized destroyed evidence or committed a torture, as long as it was done where it benefited him. Anyone who takes a minute and queries the internet on whether Obama is liberal or conservative will immediately find tens of thousands of articles about Obama as a conservative's dream. Obama is the black president Republican. Obama the Republican, and he is it. He continues the harsh war on drug policy of his predecessors, and his Justice Department continues to treat marijuana as a dangerous drug and even cracking down on medical marijuana dispensaries and growers. And like the GOP, he has avoided the issue of race in any proactive regard. He has done nothing to improve the minority's ability to vote and prevent voter fraud in minority districts. Very little changed from the Bush regime to the end of Obama's first term regarding civil liberties, militarism, corporate influence on government, secrecy, the war on drugs and terror, the environment. In fact, Obama further expanded the Bush's radical policies. On immigration, well, he ran against Bush's policies, which he promised to reform in office. He continued Bush's agenda, but even worse. The deportations and incarceration skyrocketed to over 3 to 4 million he deported. Obama's waged more wars and conducted more regime change than any president in American history. Obama has surpassed both Reagan and Bush in defense spending with the largest budget since World War II, especially to operate his secret wars in now 75 countries. He deregulated arms exports to increase U.S. market share for weapons industry. So when someone is being shot, killed, blown up, cluster bombs, any kind of chemical agent, you can bet, more likely not, it was made, sanctioned by the State Department and sold through the USA. Executive order in 2010 to waive Child Soldier Prevention Act to continue supplying arms to kid soldiers in Chad, the Congo, Sudan, and Yemen. Didn't know about that? Do your homework. This is the man you think so much of. He continues the same Christian right support for Israel, which he sees as doing no evil, and the rest of the world sees it for what it is, operating the largest apartheid prison in history. And for the Arab Spring, be realistic. Obama, and more so Hillary Clinton, defended Ben Ali regime in Tunisia, which was shooting into crowds and protesters. He staunchly supported Mubarak in Egypt. Obama and Clinton both called Mubarak a friend, who was the largest recipient of U.S. military aid at the time, being used against their own citizens. In Bahrain, home of many U.S. corporate activities and numerous contracts, supported the royal family against protests by the poorest people in the country, the Shiite majority. He sided with the minority who had the power. Obama did nothing as Bahrain brutally suppressed the protests. Many people, including doctors, nurses, teachers, and intellectuals, simply disappeared or were killed. In Yemen, President Ali Salih is a main U.S. Partner in the fight against al-Qaeda. During peaceful protests in 2011, when many were killed by snipers, Obama and Clinton completely ignored protesters' pleas to the White House because Obama wanted to keep Salih in power. Then we know the stories of Libya and Syria. And ultimately in economics, responsible for finalizing the $816 billion bank bailouts and much more, extended the Bush tax cuts to the wealthy for 2 years, corporate profits and executive salaries and bonuses have reached record levels, and Obamacare is strictly conservative, non-socialistic, and supports private interest and privatization of health. And remember, it is modeled off Mitt Romney and conservative Heritage Foundation's health plan in Massachusetts. Well, there you have that. These are perspectives. The next time you hear a pundit saying someone's liberal, someone's conservative, someone's progressive, none of them are liberal, none of them are progressive. They are all right-wing, radicalized, super hawks, multinationalists, anti-union, anti-humanistic, anti-spiritual people. Just remember that when you vote or you listen or you support them. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening.